From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The solution is simple. We make a long list. We write down all the immigrants on the list, and then we kick them all out.
That was New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo last week, speaking at a rally in New York for former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
And then to make sure they don't come back, we build a wall. The wall, the big wall, a long wall, a thousand-mile wall, like the China Wall. But wider, but higher, but nicer. Good-looking wall. I'm going to build the wall. Don't worry, the wall is a beautiful wall.
Despite those jabs from the governor and from many other quarters, Trump's candidacy has taken on the appearance of a sociological event, most recently evidenced by his sweep of three of this past Tuesday's four Republican primaries. Senator Bernie Sanders pulled off his biggest win of the Democratic presidential race Tuesday, defeating Hillary Clinton in the Michigan primary, where strong anti-establishment support for Donald Trump was also evident. For Sanders, Michigan was a prize denied to then-Senator Barack Obama in 2008, when the state was one of two, along with Florida, that had initially seen its delegates disqualified for running its primary earlier in the year than the rules of the party allowed. Clinton won Michigan after Obama closed up his campaign there in deference to the party's rules. She continued to campaign and won, ultimately gaining half the state's delegate votes in a compromise. Sanders' campaign appeared to resonate in an industrial state hit hard by the decline of manufacturing, but he also showed signs of cutting into Clinton's dominance among African-American voters. His upset victory came after recent polls had showed him trailing the former Secretary of State by about 21 points. But the Michigan vote may be an indication of which way both black and white working-class voters are leaning. Professor Anthony Montero discussed the role being played by Trump and the surprise winner in Michigan's Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders, via telephone this past weekend.
You know, it's very clear that as a personality on the political stage, Donald Trump is kind of an absurdist, cartoonish figure. But below the drama and theatrics that define Donald Trump is a movement of disaffected white, mainly working class and lower middle class, although not exclusively them, people who close to 40 years ago were seduced and brought into the Republican Party under the paradigm of the Southern strategy and then the Reagan Revolution, where they abandoned any notion of class solidarity for race identity, and the whole discourse, be it on the religious or cultural wars or all of these issues of abortion, at the end of the day, and the subtext was white supremacy. So the very white working people, what came to be called Reagan Democrats, we could also have called them George Wallace Democrats, who abandoned class for whiteness and race supremacy, are now caught in a double crisis of both the white supremacist ideology and social system, which is unable to produce for them what the outcomes that they were told it would produce, and on the other side, which is not separate but interacts with it, a deepening crisis of the American economic neoliberal system. And this is the last thing I would say. I think what is going on in the Republican Party is going to infect the Democratic primary season going forward. I think what we see, this boldness, this brashness, this I don't give a damn attitude that Trump brings to the political stage is going to be demanded of Bernie Sanders. Now, it's going to be difficult for him because he's not a reality TV personality, because the same thing, the same objective factors driving the Trump movement are the same objective economic factors driving the Bernie Sanders thing. Because, well, the absent, so to speak, factor in this whole project at this point is what will African-Americans do. And I would suggest that the African-American people as a group are still watching and looking.
As we reported earlier, as China saw two of its top institutions convene over the past week, its People's Political Consultative Conference, or the CPPCC, and the National People's Congress, a U.S. naval task force entered the South China Sea, and Washington announced impending joint military exercises with Japan and India. For more on this, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University, via Skype Wednesday. Mark Sloboda, welcome back. Pleasure as always.
Don, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR with you.
So China has its two main popular groupings, the CPPCC and the National People's Congress, having met over the past few days at the same time that the U.S. sends a carrier group into the South China Sea and is conducting war games across the whole area. What kind of message is Washington trying to send, and why?
Okay, well, it's obvious that Washington is saber-rattling. I mean, this can't be read as any other interpretation of events. To send a carrier strike group, a very specific, very large and very capable force into the South China Sea, which, however much the U.S. would like it to be otherwise, is very much China's geographic pond off their coast. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, they are directly challenging China's territorial claims to various small islands and islets, atolls within the South China Sea. Over the past two decades, we have seen a race between and conflicting claims of sovereignty over various small rocks, atolls, most of less than island size in the South China Sea by particularly the Philippines, Malaysia, Japan, Taiwan, and coming late to the game, but coming on strong, is China. And basically, the U.S. is upset that China is doing what all of the U.S.'s assembled allies have been doing for a very long period of time. I see it as China doing it in response and building up their strategic placement in the South China Sea in accord to their national interests, but primarily as a responsive mechanism. But when China does something of this scale, they come on hard. On top of that, we have the U.S. is also conducting naval exercises, rather large naval exercises in the area with Japan and India. And it is particularly interesting that India is participating in these exercises. Mm. We can automatically assume that Japan is going to be participating in anything the U.S. does. They have really very little of what we can consider an independent foreign policy, particularly when it comes to military matters in the West Pacific. But India has long tried to distance itself from this growing U.S. declared attempt to create a containment zone around China, which is what the West's self-declared Asian pivot has unfortunately come exactly to mean.
Yeah, and it's a BRICS country. You know, it's one of the BRICS too, with China.
It is one of the BRICS. Now, the China, India, of course, has their own national interests. The South China Sea is an extremely important area to India as well. for freedom of navigation, for commercial shipping, and other things. So China has tried to perhaps take a step back and hasn't been quite as willing thus far to engage in this type of exercise. Not only is it a member of BRICS, but China is now joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as well, which at least within the Eurasian continent has a very definite security and military function.
India
is joining, as Pakistan is joining as well. And it is, of course, hoped that membership will help alleviate some of the strategic tensions between India and China, as well as between India and Pakistan, of course. The way they so completely erase strategic tensions between China and Russia over the last 10, 15 years.
Right.
But this certainly won't be taken kindly by China. I believe it is a mistake by India to get involved, particularly in this specific area when tensions are so particularly high. And they are very high right now. And then just further north, also within the northern end of the Western Pacific, we have the U.S. and South Korea, evidently in response to Russia or to North Korea conducting another ballistic missile test, to hold the largest ever war games right. on the Korean Peninsula, and when as soon as you see something like that, you know that this is not just another normal exercise. This is 300,000 South Korean troops, along with 15,000 U.S. troops, engaging in war games on the Korean border. The DMZ of which is the most heavily militarized tinderbox in the world. This is Obama, I would say, going a step beyond saber rattling to a direct provocation. And both China and Russia are looking on with concern. They both agreed to a UN Security Council resolution condemning North Korea for conducting the ballistic test. Calling for it to cease such tests, but that is a very measured response. They certainly don't want to see such war games in the area, particularly as everyone knows that war games are frequently used not only for practice purposes, but also as a cover, as a potential cover for real military action that could unfold at any time.
Because you actually, for people to just keep in mind, what you're doing actually is placing the assets into the theater, and that's been happening from the Baltics all the way across to Korea, as far as Russia and China are concerned.
Yeah, as long as the war games are being conducted there, that is putting them within the area for the potential of use. Whereas, they normally wouldn't be such large forces at such a high level of combat readiness in the area. Mm-hmm. So whenever countries are conducting such large military exercises within a area of tension or conflict, there is always a cause for concern and heightened awareness because it goes beyond normal military exercises to then have the potential to be of actual military use. What it has the effect of is only increasing the climate of tensions that is already going on.
Because there would have to be also a corresponding reflexive placement of assets to counter the ones being placed into the theater around Russia and China, just logically speaking, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, and this has to do with the ongoing, no longer secret negotiations to put the THAAD high aerial defense system within South Korea, which is really of very limited use against North Korea, but is very much of strategic concern to both China and Russia's own deterrent capability. So that is a threat to both of them, and they will automatically seek to take actions to mitigate that chess move into the region. A lot of this is extremely interesting because particularly in the flashpoint right now in the South China Sea, within several small groupings within the Spratly Islands. And again, we are looking at contested claims to these islands by multiple sources. Taiwan, the Philippines, Malaysia has some interests in there, and China.
And Vietnam right too, now, right? Vietnam too, right?
And Vietnam as well. Yeah, there's a few islands within the Spratly group that are claimed by Vietnam as well. And so we have these ostensible allies that the U.S. continues to try to herd into this anti-Chinese alliance, also having competing claims against each other. But, of course, the elephant in the room on either side is the China and the United States. And it's really interesting because China, the U.S. government's official rhetorical position is that it takes no stance on ownership or claims to sovereignty over any of these island groups or sub-island groups within the area, which, of course, it would sound very strange as it does, right. If it did, because the China, U.S. is on the other side of the world and shouldn't have any say in what goes on there. But in reality, all of these U.S. claims to be driving freedom of navigation exercises with military warships within close range of these isles against the express wishes of the Chinese and military overflight, of course, directly challenges them. At the same time, the U.S. also is doing everything it can to reinforce the claims of its allies. And there has even been discussion, I don't know whether anything has actually been placed yet, such things are often announced afterward, that the U.S. intends to put mobile artillery pieces such as howitzers on the islands that are claimed by its islands, which by its allies, which would include the Philippines possibly others, but definitely the Philippines in the area. And the Philippines has very limited military capability. I heard recently someone mentioning a U.S. A policy expert in the region that the entire Philippines naval budget is the equivalent of one U.S. Arleigh Burke class warship.
But there are a lot of those on the Philippines, though, aren't there? The U.S. has a huge military presence there.
The U.S. has a huge military presence there. It was just reinforced in 2014 by a new deal giving them access to Philippines military bases. In the last decade before, there had been some take back where the Philippines had basically pushed the U.S. Navy out. But in recent years, the U.S. has lobbied for and been given access once again.
You know, and that was over wide public opinion opposed to that. And that's an interesting aspect, because if you look at the historical relationships involved on the side of the people that are conducting these drills with the U.S. and perhaps, an embryonic invasion force or whatever, war force, in Korea, you had Korea, all of it, including South Korea, suffered from the Japanese along with China. And that leaves a long memory on the people of both Koreas, North and South Korea. And I'm wondering there, and also with a member of the BRICS involved in another task group, India, if the shooting actually started, which way some of these people would be shooting?
Yeah, it's a question. I don't believe that India certainly right now would get involved in any type of military conflict with China in the South China Sea. They might be, you know, providing a limited number of ships for some supposed freedom of navigation and, you know, military exercises, but to get involved in a shooting war with China in the South China Sea would not be to their interest right now. But I think Japan and South Korea would definitely, because their foreign policy elites, their governments, their militaries are, you know, very much aligned with the United States. Whatever public opinion on any particular basing, you know, in Okinawa, of which there is always present protests against, South Korea, the Philippines, that's another thing aside, because even in our own countries, Western countries, and even in Russia and China, public opinion of such things as security, foreign policy, isn't really considered of primary importance in such matters.
Particularly military action, right?
You end up getting, military action. I mean, we saw that with, you know, protests against the Iraq war in the United States, which were quite large, and also in the United Kingdom and completely dismissed. But, you know, we've seen that, you know, repeatedly over through the years. It takes a really, really high level of public opposition, such as occurred over years of mounting oppositions during the Vietnam War to have any substantial effect on policy planning, and certainly we don't have that in any of these cases.
In Korea, you have an interesting dynamic in Korea, because there's been an awful lot of business trade dealing going on between China and South Korea, and there must be an aspect of the business elite there that would rather face towards China.
Sure, and you see the exact same thing. I've had conversations with people from the Taiwan, you know, particularly in the business field, but students and others as well, that really don't see a future in conflict with China. They don't see China necessarily as an aggressor, and they see that their lives would be substantially better off seeking a compromise and, working with China rather than seeking to create a blocks or be a part of blocks, arrayed against it. The same thing in the Koreas and Japan as well. I'm of a belief that, you know, hopefully your listeners, I think, all probably know that it is primarily the U.S. that has resisted any permanent agreement to peace with North Korea ongoing since the ostensible end to the Korean conflict, that the U.S. refuses basically the right of North Korea to exist, and that it refuses to sign any type of permanent peace treaty with it. And this is what North Korea is always doing. With its attempts to build a nuclear deterrent, with its missile tests, with its military exercises, it always rhetorically says, even though this is very rarely reported in the Western press, is that it wants a permanent peace treaty, and it views, you know, its survival always at question. Because the U.S. refuses to recognize its right to exist and refuses to accede to any type of formal peace. And I believe that is because the U.S. does not want South Korea and North Korea to reunify under any conditions except the complete collapse of North Korea. What would happen then? And first of all, you would have then some type of compromise government where people from North Korea would, you know, be involved at some level of decision making. But more importantly, it would remove the threat to South Korea.
Right.
And so South Korea, United Korea, would naturally start to develop its own sense of national and geopolitical interests. It wouldn't have the threat of its other half. And historically, and for very good geopolitical reasons, there have long been tensions between Korea and Japan. You know, given the opportunity, to some extent, we could see an increase in those tensions and likely also Korea, United Korea, drawing closer because of commercial interests, at the very least, to China. And these are things that the United States will simply not accept. Therefore, they do not want a reunification of the Korea Peninsula, again, under any conditions except the complete collapse of North Korea. And, you know, they act to continue this frozen conflict there because it is, they see it as in their geopolitical interests. Whereas China and Russia would very much like to see this over with. Right. And they continue to apply what leverage they can to the situation to keep things calm and push very, very incrementally for, you know, the opening of relations between North and South Korea, because it's in their geopolitical interest to do so.
Is this sort of an Asian version of and post-Cold War, quote-unquote, version of what happened in Germany?
What specifically?
Well, from the U.S. side, yeah. Looking basically to absorb North Korea so that a united Korea, if it came into existence, and which would be a formidable player, by the way, it would have a huge economy, would be under the direct control of the United States, more or less.
Yeah, first of all, it would have not only have a huge economy, it would also have a very substantial military force. I mean, they would have to be integrated, and, you know, we're getting into the very theoretical there, and, you know, maybe some of North Korea's would be considered out of date, but substantial in size.
Nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, but...
Yeah, nuclear, yeah, I mean, it certainly, it couldn't be disregarded. Again, it would be very hard to integrate, and we're getting into the highly theoretical, but, yeah... This all has to, you know, go back to promises that were made to Gorbachev and the Soviet Union that no reunited Germany would ever join NATO, and that NATO would not step one foot eastward. And, you know, this was given verbally and such assurances were made, but nothing was ever signed. And, you know, Gorbachev was basically naive and snowballed again and again and again. Believed everything he was said without any legal guarantees or documents being signed. And, you know, the U.S. continues to maintain that position today as they push for advancing NATO ever, ever closer and, you know, now right on Russia's borders and say, we didn't sign anything. No promises were made that we can be held to anyway. And, you know, such duplicity in that situation should certainly be factored in to any consideration of what the U.S. Is doing or would do on the question of Korean reunification.
Meanwhile, the top civil society organization, the CPPCC, and the top legislative body in China have been meeting since last Friday, I think, making all kinds of policy. And I'm wondering how some of that bears on the moves being made by the United States.
Well, certainly it is a reaction for domestic reasons and domestic consumption to what certainly must be viewed not only by the Chinese government, by, you know, the large portion of the Chinese public, you know, that largely supports it as a threat. And they have to be seen publicly to be responding to the threat. Legislative bodies meeting, making declarations and statements, you know, are very important, particularly in China, which does have such a unified position on such things. You know, you see very little being said or done by such bodies that doesn't fit harmoniously right in with China's overarching, political position. But I would be far more concerned with what such equivalent bodies of the U.S.'s National Security Council or, you know, what is being discussed in their Chinese equivalents to the situation, how they will respond.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.